Greetings, listeners and friends of the RAOTC. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying welcome to this broadcast for August 2021. I am Bruce, VK3UV, and...
I am Ian, VK3JS.
And together we hope you'll enjoy this bulletin of news and information. This broadcast is relayed on a number of frequencies on the first Monday of the month, except for January. The transmissions emanate from many different sources, and the actual times and frequencies may be found on our website, www.raotc.org.au. Now, I'd also like to thank all of our volunteers who have helped with the relaying of this broadcast. Club News. Here is Ian with a special announcement.
Hello, listeners. I hope you've been keeping well and busy during the recent lockdown. In June, we told you with great pride and joy about the award of an Order of Australia medal to our hard-working editor, Bill Roper, VK3BR. What we did not know at the time was that another RAOTC member has received a similar award in the Queen's Birthday Honours list in June. And that award goes to Barry Abley, VK3SY. We congratulate Barry most sincerely. The award being issued for his service to the Uniting Church of Australia over 70 years, to the Order of St John of Jerusalem, for services to the Geelong and District sub-branch of the National Servicemen's Association and the Geelong sub-branch of the RSL, services to the Geelong Amateur Radio Club, to the community, and as an author. Barry has obviously been a very active worker for those organisations and for organisations within the community in general. Our very sincere best wishes and congratulations to Barry, VK3SY.
Thank you, Ian. Now we have one new member and unfortunately one silent key. Our new member is John Gutef, VK6FD, previous call sign VK6ZFD, and he became new full RAOTC member number 1817, on the 23rd of June, 2021. And we now have been advised of the passing of Bill Babb, VK3AQB, RAOTC member number 904, and he became a silent key on the 21st of June at the age of 96. We pause for a few moments in memory of our departed colleague. Thank you. Here is a special item from Board Member Peter Clee, VK8ZZ. Peter is also a WIA Director. Thanks, Peter.
The Wireless Institute of Australia recently made a submission to the ACMA in response to the 5-year spectrum outlook. The WIA saw that, for the amateur service, there were two key items on the ACMA's agenda that are of special interest to radio amateurs. Firstly, continued work on the non-assigned amateur service licensing review, and secondly, the review of arrangements for amateur service stations operating at increased transmitter power levels. The first item has been addressed recently with the ACMA consultation on amateur and outpost licenses. The WIA made a significant submission on this subject. That submission led to a meeting between the WIA and relevant staff of the ACMA to discuss the submission. The ACMA and the WIA will have an ongoing dialogue in relation to this matter. The second review is proposed by the ACMA to commence in the second quarter of 2022. The WIA welcomes the opportunity to again explore how Australian amateur licensees can operate with higher transmitter power. The WIA has drawn the attention to the ACMA to a number of other key issues it believes are very important to the amateur service at this time. Firstly, to define and implement a new model for managing AOCP syllabus that retains amateur service engagement in the process. Secondly, a review of the effectiveness of the amateur service examination system in light of the lack of growth of newly licensed amateurs in Australia, particularly throughout 2020 under COVID, when compared to other countries who experienced significant increase in amateur numbers. And thirdly, the spectrum access related items that the WIA continues to advocate to the ACMA. For this round of the 5-year spectrum outlook, the WIA is seeking to address the following matters: an extension of operating privileges for AOCP standard class licensees to include access to the 50 to 52 MHz band, a further review of the defined usage of 7.1 to 7.2 MHz in the Australian Radio Spectrum Plan, and thirdly, access to the 60 metre band. It is unfortunate that opposition from military and commercial users makes this item difficult to attain in the immediate future. As the International Amateur Radio Union representative in Australia, the Wireless Institute of Australia is the only authority authorised to recommend to the IARU the use of amateur frequencies in satellites. The WIA has recently published a policy document on the requirements for processing Australian amateur satellite licence applications. The WIA has authorised the BINAR-1 project as well as tentatively authorised the CIROSAT-1 project. The IARU is responsible for amateur radio band planning. The WIA represents Australia at the IARU Triennial Conference, where decisions on changes to the band plan are ratified. Subsequently, the WIA implements the IARU plans domestically. The next IARU Region 3 conference will be an online event to be held this September. Just ending on a personal note now, I advise that this week I had my second jab of AstraZeneca. I wanted to report that I had no ill effects with either the first or the second jab. As an at-risk asthmatic, I am happy to be immunised. Cheers all. This is Peter Clee, VK8ZZ, the Director and Secretary of the Wireless Institute of Australia and a committee member of the Radio Amateur Old-Timers Club.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old-Timers Club of Australia. Now here is Ian once again with some articles for you.
In my search for articles of a more modern nature, which I thought would be of interest to you, in mid-June I came across an article in Cosmos magazine, a publication of the Royal Institution of Australia, written by science writer Lauren Fuge. And she asks the question, can we monitor earthquakes with transoceanic cables? This is what she writes. What if we could monitor what goes on at the inaccessible depths of oceans using infrastructure that's already there? In a new study published in the journal Optica, researchers show that millions of kilometres of fibre optic cables crisscrossing the ocean floor can not only be used to send data streaming across the world, but also to sense what's going on around them, including monitoring geophysical events and observing ocean and seafloor conditions. This could result in a global network of underwater cables studying otherwise unreachable parts of the planet. Quote, once perfected, this new technique will allow geophysical sensing in the ocean depths, which are largely unexplored because of a lack of instrumentation that works in this environment, end of quote, explains Chongwen Zhan, co-author of a study and a geophysicist at Caltech in the US. Quote, it could one day be used to detect earthquakes with epicenters in the ocean, allowing earlier warnings of earthquakes and tsunamis, for example. End of quote. Mr. Zan, along with researchers from Google and the University of L'Aquila in Italy, studied the Curie transoceanic fiber optic cable. It's owned by Google and stretches 10,500 kilometres from Los Angeles, California to Valparaiso, Chile. it began transmitting only last year. Cables like Curie encode data into the amplitude and phase of light, which is then transmitted through the link. The team found that changes in the ocean environment around the cable, such as earthquakes or pressure variations, cause tiny but detectable changes in the light's polarization, which they observed in the receiver at the end of the cable. Quote, "We developed the theoretical framework required to interpret polarization data in submarine cables, which will enable further quantitative understanding of submarine geophysical processes," end of quote, explains Mr. Zan. The researchers used the technique to detect deep sea earthquakes and ocean swells, which aligned with measurements made with land-based seismometers. Previous research has used submarine links to sense geophysical events in the Mediterranean, but needed to use specialized lasers. The new study required only standard telecommunications equipment. Quote, "In addition," Mr. Zan notes, "there is no need for a dedicated light channel because the data required for sensing can be collected without disturbing the regular operation of the optical transmission system." Well, how about that? Amazing what can be developed these days. Always developments going on everywhere in almost every field. I'll look for something similar to bring to you on future occasions. Hope you found it interesting.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.
Today, I want to talk to you a little bit about what's going on in space. You may know that in Australia, there is quite a move to launch CubeSats. And toward the end of June, an article appeared in Cosmos magazine, written by Tori Shepherd, a journalist with the Adelaide Advertiser, who writes about space matters. The article is headed "Go-Go Gadget CubeSat," a CubeSat that will split in two so it can fly in formation will use a bee's eye sensor to feed information back to Earth, Australia's new space commander has told Parliament. Air Vice Marshal Catherine Roberts also told a federal inquiry into the space industry about the dangers of space debris as space gets more congested. The M2 CubeSat was launched into orbit in March and early in June demonstrated Australia's first in-orbit use of artificial intelligence by correctly recognising handwritten characters. That was a crucial test of its capability before the 12-unit spacecraft is split into two 6-unit craft using a built-in spring. Air Vice Marshal Roberts told the inquiry that the M2 mission, a collaboration between the University of New South Wales, Canberra Space and the Royal Australian Air Force, is testing a range of new Australian-made technology. Quote, "It flies in formation," she said. "That allows you to test how to fly in low Earth orbit, which is tricky. It also allows us to test communications and allows us to test whether or not we can detect the two satellites that are very close together. That's important for space domain awareness, for knowing what is going on. And we have a sensor that's a new development, a sensor which is a bit like a bee's eye so it can detect motion." End of quote. The two parts of the M2 will communicate with each other and control the formation using an intra-satellite link. Still whole, M2 has star tracking technology for navigation, onboard computers and processing power. The neuromorphic event-based sensor, which mimics biological sensing abilities, will detect new or different things happening in space. University of New South Wales Canberra Space Director Professor Russell Boyce says the AI test was a significant step towards developing, quote, "intelligent, networked satellite constellation technologies." This is a necessary step before separating the two spacecraft from each other, and as the mission unfolds, coupling our artificial intelligence algorithms and onboard sensors to perform tasks such as cloud detection and maritime surveillance. The UNSW Canberra space team has been tirelessly working behind the scenes towards the separation of dual satellite M2 in the near term. The lessons learnt from this mission will make a significant contribution to the ramp up in Australia's sovereign space technologies, expertise and capabilities that can only come through tackling the challenges of space again and again. End of quote. Department of Defence announced earlier this year that it was creating a new space command and that Air Vice Marshal Roberts would start at the top space gig as Space Division head. She is already the head of Air Force capability with responsibility for space. Well, there's something different for you. But be aware, there are so many CubeSats and satellites of normal size out there at the moment. Anybody wanting to go to Mars or the Moon or somewhere just might have difficulty finding a path through. Ah, well, that'll be something for them to solve in the future. Take care.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. The following article discusses solar flares, which, as most of you know, can affect HF and VHF communications. A solar flare is a sudden flash of increased brightness of the sun, usually observed near its surface and in close proximity to a sunspot group. Powerful flares are often, but not always, accompanied by a coronal mass ejection, a CME. Even the most powerful flares are barely detectable in the total solar irradiance, the solar constant. Solar flares occur in a power law spectrum of magnitudes. An energy release of typically 10 to 20 joules of energy suffices to produce a clearly observable event, while a major event can emit up to 10 to the 25th joules. Although originally observed in the visible electromagnetic spectrum, especially in the H-alpha emission line of hydrogen, they can now be detected from radio waves to gamma waves. Flares are closely associated with the ejection of plasmas and particles through the sun's corona into outer space. Flares also copiously emit radio waves. If the ejection is in the direction of the Earth, particles associated with this disturbance can penetrate into the upper atmosphere, the ionosphere, and cause bright auroras, and may even disrupt long-range radio communication. It usually takes several days for the solar plasma ejector to reach Earth. Solar flares affect all layers of the solar atmosphere, photosphere, chromosphere, and corona. The plasma medium is heated to tens of millions of kelvins, while electrons, protons, and heavier ions are accelerated to near the speed of light. Flares produce electromagnetic radiation across the electromagnetic spectrum at all wavelengths, from radio waves to gamma rays. Most of the energy is spread over frequencies outside the visual range, and so the majority of the flares are not visible to the naked eye and must be observed with special instruments. Flares occur in active regions around sunspots, where intense magnetic fields penetrate the photosphere to link the corona to the solar interior. Flares are powered by the sudden release of magnetic energy stored in the corona. The same energy releases may produce coronal mass ejections, although the relationship between CMEs and flares is still not well understood. The frequency of occurrence of solar flares varies, from several per day when the sun is particularly active to less than one every week when the sun is dormant. Following the 11-year cycle, the solar cycle, large flares are less frequent than smaller ones. Now here is an event which occurred on the 3rd of July 2021. And we thank RAOTC committee member John Cheeseman, VK3XM, for sending us the following item from the ARRL's QST. And it is headed, First X-Class Major Solar Flare of Cycle 25, Blacks Out HF on the 3rd of July. For a brief time on the 3rd of July, a lot of radio amateurs were wondering, where did the bands go? As the first X-class solar flare in 4 years blacked out HF propagation for a time. I was on 20-meter FT8 and my waterfall display went from solid red signals to solid nothing in the blink of an eye, Scott Craig, WA4TTK, told KR7RA solar update editor Tad Cook. It lasted about 10 minutes. Craig was not alone. Many American radio amateurs reported sudden HF propagation blackouts on Saturday morning, 3rd of July, when solar active region 12838 produced her next 1.5 major solar flare that reached maximum intensity at 1429 UTC. The first X-class solar flare of cycle 25 and the first since 2017, said Frank Donovan, W3LPL. HF propagation blackouts are caused when X-ray and extreme ultraviolet radiation from X-class solar flares strongly ionizes the absorbing D region in the Earth's sun-facing dense lower ionosphere, he explained. Such a radio blackout occurs when a pulse of X-rays ionize the top layer of the atmosphere, the exosphere. In this instant, it caused what NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center, the SWPC, calls an R3 level or strong radio blackout on a scale of R1 to R5. An R3 incident can cause a wide area blackout of HF radio propagation and loss of radio contact for about an hour on the sunlit side of Earth. Low frequency navigation signals degraded for about an hour. Donovan said that X-class major solar flares are necessary consequences of steadily increasing solar cycle 25 activity. 95% of all X-class solar flares occur when the solar flux index is 90 or greater. The remaining 5% can occur at any time during the solar cycle. X1 class major solar flares typically degrade HF propagation for only an hour or two and only on Earth's sunlit side. X-class major flares are measured on an open-ended scale. The strongest one ever recorded was an X-28 flare in 2003, hundreds of times more powerful than the 3rd of July X-1.5 solar flare. X-10 class and stronger solar flares typically have effects that last for most of a day and affect the entire sunlit side of the Earth. Fortunately, X-10 class solar flares occur only once every 20 years or so. Much more severe and long-lasting HF propagation degradations are often caused by the coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, often associated with, but not caused by, major solar flares, Donovan explained. HF propagation degradation caused by CMEs typically begins about 2 days after the effects of the associated solar flare. The duration of the delay depending on interactions between the CME and the solar wind. The CME associated with the 3rd of July X1.5 solar flare is likely to have little or no effect on HF propagation going forward, because the active region was very close to the western edge of the visible solar disk when the CME erupted. Region 12838 rotated off the visible disk on Sunday, 4th of July. Solar flares have no significant effect on VHF ionospheric propagation, but can degrade satellite communications passing through the ionosphere. More frequent, less powerful M-class solar flares produce short-duration degradation at high latitudes. Very frequent, much weaker A, B, and C-class solar flares do not degrade HF propagation. And we hope that you found something of interest in this article. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. This brings us to the close of our session for this month, and it has been a long-standing practice to finish off with something humorous. So here is today's offering. The rich industrialist was horrified to find the fisherman lying beside his boat, smoking a pipe. "Why aren't you out fishing?" asked the industrialist. "Because I have caught enough fish for the day." "Why don't you catch some more?" "What would I do with them?" "You could earn more money. Then you could go and have a motor fitted to your boat to go deeper into the waters and catch more fish. Then you would have enough money to buy nylon nets, and these would bring you more fish and more money. Soon you would have enough money to own two boats, maybe even a fleet of boats. Then you would be a rich man like me." "What would I do then?" "Well, you could then sit back and enjoy life." "What do you think I'm doing now?" Thank you for listening. This now concludes our session for this month, and Ian and I hope that you have found something of interest. All being well, we shall be back with you on Monday, the 6th of September, 2021. If you want to contact us, please do so via our website, which is www.raotc.org.au. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying 73, and listening now for any check-ins and callbacks for those relay stations that have an operator available. Thank you.